This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's Fashion Week in London this week, and the buzz there is not just about the designs on the runways, but also the models wearing them. The health of models has become a bigger issue over the past 2 years. Critics charge that they're too thin and raise questions about how they maintain the weight that allows them to fit into designer dresses. Kate Spicer, a journalist for the Sunday Times in London, wondered about this. A healthy, fit, normal-sized 38-year-old who described herself as just a wee bit porky, she agreed to participate in a BBC America documentary that shows what many women go through to achieve the mythical size zero, and found herself obsessed by food and diets and workouts and goals and by her body image. After 5 weeks, she had to stop. How far have you gone when it comes to dieting? What are your limits? Was there a turning point for you? Tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can share your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, we'll talk with an expert on military law about the Pentagon's plans to ask for the death penalty in the trials of six 9/11 suspects held at Guantanamo Bay. But first, Kate Spicer joins us from the BBC studios in London, where she writes for the Sunday Times. She appeared in the documentary Super Skinny Me, and nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And among other things, you're a restaurant critic. Why did you decide to follow a lifestyle where 10 raisins, 10 nuts, and a tablespoon of maple syrup passed for a feast?
I think I was just fascinated by the whole size zero thing had blown up last year in London, and people were just entranced by it. And I was sort of like, you know, why? This isn't war. It isn't even about fashion and beautiful clothes. It's just about skinny women. People are so engaged and interested in it. I just thought, let's try and immerse ourselves in the worlds of those women who actually do manage to stay in those crazy little skinny dresses and their bony little arms. And let's just, they're always presented as so glamorous. You see them on the red carpet in their tiny little dresses. But actually, what are they really going through to present that image?
And you went through that yourself, beginning with, well, a concoction that sounds absolutely vile.
What was amazing about doing this is that it sounds like a joke when you say it. You know, it was lemon juice, water, cayenne pepper, and maple syrup. And that's all you're allowed to have for up to 20 days. And I thought, oh, my God, this just sounds like a joke. But I started doing it. Literally, it was around this time last year. And, of course, it was January. And I suddenly started noticing all these sort of empty bottles with little red grains in them and a little bit of lemon juice at the bottom. And I thought, hang on, quite a lot of people are going off to work every day with just a litre of essentially hot lemon juice to drink. And I got so hungry on that diet. I literally woke up, I would get up in the night, and in my sleep would subconsciously be reaching for food from the cupboard. And yet that's a diet that's actually quite a common means that people use to drop weight.
Another thing is the incessant workouts.
Yeah, well, I went off on our fasting clinic, and I exercised twice a day, and I think exercising twice a day is seen as quite an acceptable way of losing weight in Hollywood and getting, you know, sort of movie fit, if you like. So I was eating, you know, practically nothing and, liquids only, and exercising twice a day. And the loss in my strength was unbelievable. But, you know, I kept going for it and going for it. And you start to live on little sort of bumps of energy. So the exercise would give me a little bump of energy and release some endorphins, and I'd feel good for about 10 minutes, then I'd come crashing back down again. I mean, it was like the worst. It was like really extreme manic depression. One minute you're up, next minute you're down. One minute you're up, next minute you're down. And it really, a really strange, almost trippy experience.
In week two, when an old friend asks me how I'm getting on and I grumble about how stupid it all is and say how sorry I feel for women who have to live out their lives in this state of privation, she's cynical. I think you're enjoying this, she says, knowing me better than myself at times.
Yeah, and what's interesting is when the Super Skinny Me screened in America, there was I found this blog where they were discussing it, and it was an athlete's blog, and this woman was saying, when I first saw this documentary in England, I thought this woman was an idiot, but she was speaking about me. But then she was a cox, in a rowing cox, and she'd been told to lose weight by her trainer, and she said that she absolutely understood what that meant. She said she was, you know, she was an athlete. She's healthy attitudes towards things. She started to drop weight and she found it's very engaging, seductive feeling of getting smaller and lighter. And also there's a, I can't remember that word for it, but there is actually a kind of hunger high that you get that is quite stimulating. And I was starting to, and on top of that, adds the fact that you appear to fit into the world better. So I could I could walk into any shop and put something on and it would fit me properly. Whereas most clothes in cheaper shops aren't cut for the fuller figure. They're cut for some standard, slightly microscopic sort of figure. and you just, you know, on so many levels, on a sort of, you know, on the sort of internal body chemicals, if you like, that were released because I was hungry, you know, on a social level as well, in fashion terms, I just was feeling very powerful and very, there's a kind of arrogance you get when you become proper fashionable skinny.
And you become highly judgmental of other women.
Yeah, I think women are very judgmental of each other, but we also just crack on with our lives and don't spend our entire lives judging each other. But what I noticed was I was really aware of what other people weighed, and I'd check people out. And I would think that they were weak if they were bigger than me, if they looked a bit sort of doughy or whatever. And I think, you know, that's a terrible thing to admit, isn't it? But I think the hungrier I got and the thinner I got, the more that weird kind of sense of control, power and arrogance was nurtured in me. And I mean, it's utterly ludicrous, basically. But that is also, you know, much as it makes me sound like a bad person, that is how our women's magazines kind of perpetuate that culture. They put skinny women on the cover. They laud these beautiful skinny women. They tell us how so-and-so got thin and all that kind of stuff. So we've actually learned, even though we're emancipated, empowered individuals now as females, we actually have this really primitive tool for benchmarking each other's success, and that is how big is that person. No, and if you think, you know, 200-300 years ago, it was fat people were considered rich because food was in short supply. Nowadays, if you have the self-control not to gorge on the store of plenty we have in the West, then that's obviously, you know, a sign of success and what have you. So, I mean, much as it's easy to just point the finger at me and go, oh, you must be a loon and blah, 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 it all has, there's a cultural trail into all of this stuff.
We're talking with Kate Spicer, who participated in the documentary Super Skinny Me. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Janae. Janae's calling us from Stigler, Arizona, Oklahoma. Excuse me.
Hello, Neil.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to comment. I have two daughters, and I'm very careful to not perpetuate this skinny culture, and we don't keep Cosmo around. And if I exercise, and my daughter asked me why, I say to be strong and healthy. But she came home from school the other day and said she wanted to be on a diet.
How old is she?
I want to be on a diet. And she couldn't really tell me. But when there's the Nutrisystem commercials and the XenaFit whatever trim commercials, and I mean, I feel like I do a pretty good job of not letting her see much of that, and she doesn't need to go on a diet even in the least little bit.
And how old is she?
Six.
Six?
Yes, and I said, you know, and she couldn't really say that she wanted to lose weight, but she had just heard the term diet, probably by somebody beautiful on television, and wanted to emulate that.
Or an older girl at school, perhaps. I don't know.
Possibly, yeah.
But Kate Spicer, go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a lot of friends who are experiencing the same thing. They've got young girls, 5, 6, 7, and although they are women who perhaps deep down, you know, perhaps have little insecurity about their weight and stuff, they've been very, very careful, particularly around their daughters, not to perpetuate this culture. And they've gone to school, and at the age of 5 and 6, they've come home and said, "Mummy, I'm fat like a pig." And I think, you know, diets are, and certainly when I was young, I decided I wanted to start dieting because my friend had heard her mother talking about it and thought it was, a signifier of something grown up to go on a diet. You know, this is what I'm saying. I mean, it's fed into the culture everywhere, isn't it? It's all around us, this kind of awareness of weight and whatnot.
Yeah,
and it must be very worrying for you as a mother.
Do what?
It must be worrying for you.
Yes, it is. Because it's, you know, can we just not even watch daytime TV anymore because she's going to experience that? I mean, I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me. I was incredulous.
Hmm. I mean, do you feel like as a mother, there's somewhere you can counter it by talking constantly about strong, healthy bodies, talking about how amazing her body is, and just building up a kind of a really positive energy around bodies, so that she's got that kind of force field, if you like, when she has to go out into the mainstream culture and be bombarded with all this rubbish.
I would try. I mean, I tell her all the time how proud I am and how beautiful. And, you know, we try to talk about things other than her appearance because I feel like she has a very good self-image. You know, so we try to talk about other strengths, you know, ability to run or not run, but dance or do well in school or being kind to others, things like this. And I don't know. Hopefully I can get her out of young adulthood without an eating disorder.
And your other daughter, how old is she, Janae?
She's only 3. But it was funny because we were watching Hairspray the other day, and she saw, you know, the lead character, Tracy Turnblad, and she said, she's fat. Mm. I was like, oh, no. I said, but doesn't she sing and dance beautifully? And we've had to have this conversation. And so now they love her, and they think she's fabulous, and that's sort of, they don't think of her as the fat character anymore, thank goodness. Mm. But so anyway, I was like, people come in all shapes and sizes, and, you know, then they're beautiful and talented. So I'm trying.
Good luck, Janae.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can share your stories with us on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guest is Kate Spicer, a journalist for the Sunday Times in London. She participated in the documentary Super Skinny Me, which is airing on BBC America. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When it comes to dieting, there's a long continuum from fat-free frozen yogurt to colonics all the way to extreme calorie restriction. How far is too far? This hour, we're talking with journalist Kate Spicer. She writes for the Sunday Times in London and appeared in the documentary Super Skinny Me. And we want to hear from you. Have you flirted with crazy diets, fasted for a week, smoked for lunch? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Gary. Gary with us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Yes, I was going to say this is not merely an affliction of women. I got caught up in it because I'm fascinated by the world of professional cycling, and I like to do some amateur cycling myself. And power to weight ratio is everything. If you've ever seen anything, Lance Armstrong looks like an emaciated waif. Well, these are like 130-pound, 6-foot tall men flying up mountain passes on their bikes. And I got into that last year, and I'm almost 6 feet tall, and I was supposed to weigh, according to this Italian ideal, like 135 pounds. Well, I got within 15 pounds of that, and I had people who were ready to commit me. Because they were like, oh, you look like a concentration camp victim. You look emaciated, all that kind of stuff. Because all I was eating was like hummus, tabbouleh, and handfuls of, you know, different kind of nuts, hazelnuts and all that kind of stuff. But would only drink
and
water.
Presumably riding, what, 50 miles a day?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. I would wake up, not eat anything, and go ride 50 miles. It was a challenge to myself not to replace the calories.
Because
you can burn it. I'm serious. You can really burn down fast that way. I mean, you can lose a lot of weight. There's no doubt. But I was getting sick all the time. I don't smoke, of course, or anything like that. But I was always getting the sniffles, and I just had like no resistance. And I was definitely unhealthy, but I looked really good.
And how did it affect your
people started to comment that I wasn't looking good.
Kate Spicer, go ahead.
How did it affect your athletic performance, losing that weight? I mean, you know, give us the real answer, not necessarily the right answer. I mean, it could be that
it did boost it exponentially. For every pound I lost, I took time off. I mean, I took time off of my, you know, off of my routine.
So it worked.
And it worked wonderfully. And then it came to like a strange equilibrium where it was, I got to a point where I was about where I wanted to be with weight, and then all of a sudden my performance started to go bad. I couldn't sleep. I mean, it started to affect me that way. So right as I think I got to the point where I probably should have stopped, but the minute I stopped my diet, I gained weight like so fast, even though I was riding the same. So,
Tell me about it.
It did work. I mean, I did get better, but I also got sick.
Did you experience any kind of binging issues? Because what I found really interesting is I started to lose the weight, and for the first few weeks that was fine, but then around about week three, I started irrationally eating far too much.
That was
my kind of natural, I think my natural response to starvation. Any animal would do that. If they've got food around them and they're hungry, at some point need is gonna overtake what you necessarily desire, and you're just going to start stuffing that stuff in.
In fact, we have an excerpt from the documentary Super Skinny Me where Kate has a setback and devours the contents of her fridge.
I suddenly realised that I've basically been eating all day. I guess this is what you might call a binge. In fact, I've got a plate of quinoa, ancient South American grain, here right now, and it tastes of nothing. But I can't stop eating. I don't know if all that hunger has made me eat all this food in this strange, anxious way, but it's not right.
Gary, does that sound familiar? I think Gary's left us. Anyway.
Right.
That was a low moment for you.
It was a pretty low moment, but it was one that I was certainly familiar with, because when I was much, much younger, I used to go on crazy diets. Much younger, in my teens or whatever. And I was very familiar with that binge-purge cycle. Hmm. Not binge-purge, but, you know, starve-binge. And I think it's something that almost any woman who has been on a diet that is anything but sensible will have experienced it, because they always think, oh, it's lack of self-control. You know, you always beat yourself up and go, oh, it's lack of self-control. But actually, that is the human body's natural response to starvation. Hmm. That if there is suddenly plenty, that you gorge. And I think women, men too, I mean, they really punish themselves when they fall off a diet. But they need to look at the diet they're doing. Like, is it actually doable? Because without the assistance of legal or illegal drugs or constantly stimulating yourself with caffeine or smoking or whatever, the human body, if it sees food, it's going to want to eat it. And also the thing about hunger is it changes your brain chemistry as well. So, you know, you're not going to have quite the same control. I don't know. It's so sad to think of all those people out there on diets that are just going to turn them, you know, a minor form of crazy.
Joining us now is Dr. Jim Locke, who's the head of the Eating Center program at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford University. He's with us from a studio there, and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Dr. Locke, we talked about a continuum in dieting. I guess there's a continuum somewhere between eating disorders and disordered eating, which is what Kate Spicer's doctor told her she was doing. Can you explain the difference?
Well, yeah, it is on a continuum, and if she'd kept doing it for very much longer, she would have crossed over pretty clearly, as her behaviors already were crossing over into this binge eating phenomenon that she described so well, that she would have breached right over into binge eating disorder and maybe bulimia nervosa. So the behaviors which both she's described and the fellow from Florida described...
Gary, yeah.
Yeah, Gary... were the beginnings of disordered eating, which is the entree most often into full-blown eating disorders.
And what she was describing earlier, the sort of addiction to this, that's when you start getting into psychiatric problems.
Right. Well, there's two forms of getting addicted to it, in a sense. One is the psychological piece, which she described as having this sort of sense of control and feeling more powerful, engaged, even prideful in relationship to other people and the world, esteem building, a false kind of a self-esteem, but nonetheless one that is experienced. And the second is this physiologic response that she described also, which is you get initially, once you get adjusted to eating so little, these kinds of pulls of neurotransmitters and endorphins into your body that make it easier to do, and for short periods of time, a pleasure to do. It's quite confusing, but that's what happens. Mm. And it also, when you add exercise to it, that adds even more.
And you've told us, you know, sort of why perpetuate this obsession that she also describes. This is a cultural phenomenon.
Well, it's partly culture. The cultural messages trigger it, the capacity to pull it off, to actually really go into extreme dieting to the point where you develop anorexia, for example, probably also relies to a certain extent on some other capacities. For example, many people who would continue where she stopped, they wouldn't go into the binge cycle. They would instead just stop and continue to eat the lemon water and cayenne pepper, to continue to do the exercise, never give in to the impulse. Those highly restrained eaters are people who develop anorexia nervosa.
Hmm. Kate,
and they have a different kind of excuse me.
Go ahead. No, I didn't mean to,
They have a different kind of self-control mechanism that they can just turn off all their attention outside of them.
Okay. And Kate, I wanted to follow up and to say, when your doctor and your friend said, hey, listen, you've got to end this experiment, a documentary or no, you're getting into trouble, your first reaction was to be angry with them.
Yeah, the thing is that had I not been doing this as part of an experiment, I would have been one of the people that the doctor just described who would have just dropped out and probably at the end of day one. But for me, it was a journalistic process, and I stuck to it, you know, like I would with any other period of research. And there seemed to be some further purpose to it. So I was angry because I knew I could understand the psychology I was going through. I knew I was going a bit crazy, but I also wanted to get beyond that. Partly it was a personal thing. I'd become suckered into this crazy, crazy mindset. But also I wanted to finish the experiment. I wanted to get really, I wanted to look bad. And my anger was, anybody watching this is going to go, well, she looks great. And they've told her she's showing signs of bulimia, but she's still looking great. So I was actually a bit of an advert for the crazy behavior I'd been, you know, I'd been experimenting on the show. And I think had I gone a bit further, started to look ill and whatnot, it would have been a more powerful experiment. But there's no two ways about it. I was also suckered into it on a personal level as well. I'm not so grand that I'm not going to admit that. But yeah, I had some very difficult times after it came out. Girls coming up to me on the street, age 14, saying, you know, that was amazing, that show was so inspiring, and I've tried this, that, and the other, and I was like, oh, like grabbing them by the shoulders and shaking them, going, have you any idea how quickly I put the weight on afterwards? And did you not see how unhappy I was and how, you know, crazy I was going? And, you know, it's a minefield touching on that stuff, because a lot of people, all they want to do is lose the weight. They're not going to see all the negatives. They're just like, right, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try that, you know?
Mm. Let's get Christina on the line. Christina's calling us from Sacramento in California.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Christina.
Hi, I was calling just because there's a few different elements to my story, but I had developed bulimia at the age of 13, along with another friend. Actually, we had been at a party and had ate way too much and kind of were like, hey, you know what? We can get rid of this. And so it began like that. It was like a simple, I guess, the experiment between friends, but then it ended up being a major problem for both of us for many years after that. And it just so happened that I became pregnant at the age of 16 with my first son. And although there were a lot of other issues going on, I was very young, but I was still wise enough to know that this disorder could harm my fetus. And so basically, as soon as I found out I was pregnant, it stopped. And it, throughout the whole pregnancy, I never felt the urge to binge and purge again. And then following the pregnancy and the birth of the healthy boy and breastfeeding, I just felt like I got this newfound awe for my body and what I was able to do. And I never had the urge to abuse it like that again. And that's not to say now, you know, I'm 28 years old, and I'm in grad school and doing a thesis on nutrition, and it's very much in my mind that I know what a healthy eating pattern is, exercise, healthy weight, but I still have these moments where if I, you know, eat too much and I'm feeling really full and I think, oh, I could just throw up, and I go, well, where is this thought even coming from? You know, I don't even want to entertain that anymore, but it still lingers there, you know, 10, 11 years later, the thought that I could just make it all go away. And so I would say that it's still a bit of a battle, even now.
Christina, thanks very much for the call, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Kate Spicer, a journalist who participated in the documentary Super Skinny Me, and with Dr. James Locke of the Eating Center Program at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Dr. Locke, Christina's phone call, that starting with friends, the purging, does that sound familiar?
It does. Not just purging, but dieting. The whole community of eating around early adolescence, young women mostly together, eating together, beginning to comment on their appearance, managing their anxieties about weight gain and body changes. This is when that culture of appearance and dieting gets started. Also, then the anxieties about it and the behaviors that you'll hear about. They'll tell you about, other girls will tell other girls about purging. They'll tell them about diet pills. They'll tell them about exercise programs and lemon juice. So they'll do the whole thing. And that starts in some kids' kind of vulnerability to take it too far, as happened with your caller.
Mm-hmm. And the other part of it was the feeling that, well, this never quite goes away. The temptations still linger.
Well, she apparently was ill for a few years. And if you are ill for a few years, you can hold on to that. I do think there are people who get better and don't have as much residual worry as this particular person had. But there are many people who still fight those urges. With bulimia, once you've started doing, it's very hard for people to understand how you could ever get into the habit of binge eating and throwing up. It just doesn't sound to most people like something. How would you ever get attached to that kind of thing? But actually, you do. It relieves your anxiety. You begin to actually use binge eating and purging to manage other problems like fights with your parents or your boyfriend or your husband or something like that. And pretty soon, a behavior that was just related to weight becomes something much bigger, becomes a strategy to manage your whole life. And when that happens, it is much harder to ever get rid of the worry and the thought, even if you stop the behaviors.
And this email from Catherine in Utah, thanks for taking on this topic today. I had a serious illness a few years ago and dropped from a healthy weight to a subhealthy level in about 2 weeks. I looked bad and felt worse. When my friends and coworkers saw me, they had nothing but congratulatory messages to offer, even though I was tired and pale with dark circles under my eyes. The experience gave me a view of how far women have bought into the skinny at any cost view. To my friends, I was so lucky. I was glad to put the weight back on and resented the reaction of friends and coworkers when I did. And I wonder, Kate Spicer, if that sounds familiar too.
Oh, that sounds so familiar. I mean, this is why I wanted to get to the point of really ugly scrawniness, because everybody just kept telling me how great I looked. And I was, the slimmer I got, the more I could put on fashionable clothes. So I was looking, I was looking really good, and people were telling me I was looking really good, even though mentally things were not good at all.
As you look, have you since put the weight back on?
I have not put all of it back on, no, but I did put on a lot of weight very quickly afterwards. I was literally lying on the sofa eating a liter of Haagen-Dazs, the weight came back on, but never. I think I was a little over 140 pounds when the experiment started, and I'm probably around, 135 now or something like that. And you know what? I'm not unhappy about that weight I've lost. I'm not going to lie to you.
Kate Spicer, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Kate Spicer participated in the documentary Super Skinny Me for BBC America. She writes for the Sunday Times in London. And Dr. James Locke, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
James Locke is the head of the Eating Center Program at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford University and joined us today from a studio at Stanford. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the Pentagon's plan to initiate military commission proceedings against six men being held at Guantanamo Bay, being charged with murder, among other crimes, for the attacks on 9/11, and they will seek the death penalty. If you have questions about the procedures, the evidence, appeals, anything else about this procedure going on in Guantanamo Bay, it's about to get underway, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.